All right, well, welcome everyone. Go around and say hi to people, starting with Sydney and Bob, Kay, Franklin, Gathel, Claudia. I don't know if you can hear us. Can you hear us, Claudia? I don't think so. Marvin, Bridget, Jinryu, Sam, Shoketsu, Jeff, Mark, Susan, Jim, Karen, Bob O, Fanus, Deborah, Drew, and Ruth Ann. So welcome. Let's see, in terms of announcements, I guess I have to say there's a chance once again that I'll drop off the Zoom call and have to hook in using cell. I don't know. And Bob K, maybe you could chat Claudia and tell her she may need to leave and come back in order to get her audio. And let's see, we have a one-day retreat coming up in August. We already have like six people or so signed up for that, so we'll all be in our own homes, but we'll be together, so that should be very sweet. I think that's all I have in terms of announcements. Anyone else have anything I should mention? All right. Okay. Continuing on our study. Uchiyama Roshi's How to Cook Your Life from the Zen Kitchen to Enlightenment. Chapter 6, On Parental Mind. So as usual, just want to open it up if anybody has any particular comments or questions, something that you wanted to mention that you particularly liked or resonated with, feel free to unmute yourself and share. Well, then I will start with on page 54. Uchiyama has a paragraph that's from the Tenzo Kyokan about parental mind. So in the instructions to the head cook that Dogen wrote, and if any of you completely familiar with this, I should briefly say, all right, so Dogen lived in the 1200s, I always forget, that's the 13th century Japanese Zen master. He studied in China and brought the kind of our form of Zen to Japan. And one of the things he did was write instructions for how to organize and conduct a Soto Zen monastery. So that was a very central part of practice. So he talks about in the instructions to the chief cook, the Tenzo Kyokan, he talks about how the head cook of the monastery, this is all practice. Everything is practice. And says the cook should, and we should, of course, by extension, cultivate three minds or three attitudes. One is joyful mind. One is this parental mind, which we're going to talk about tonight, and one is magnanimous mind. And so we already talked a little bit about big mind, magnanimous mind last week. So now we're talking about parental mind. So he says, Roshin, parental mind, is the mind or attitude of a parent. In the same way that a parent cares for an only child, keep the three treasures in your mind. A parent, irrespective of poverty or difficult circumstances, loves and raises a child with care. How deep a love is this? Only a parent can understand it. A parent protects the children from the cold and shades them from the hot sun with no concern for his or her own personal welfare. Only a person in whom this mind has arisen can understand it. And only one in whom this attitude has become second nature can fully realize it. This is the ultimate in being a parent. In the same manner, when you handle water, rice, or anything else, you must have the affectionate and caring concern of a parent raising a child. So, here's where I really hope that I don't lose internet access, because I'm going to fire up a document for us to brainstorm on. And what I want to do is think about the attitude and or actions of a loving parent. Brainstorm what these things are. Just make sure that the font is large enough that we can all read it. And I'll share my screen. All right. Can people see that?
Yes.
Great. So keep in mind that not all of us had the best parents. So in some ways we're talking about an ideal, and even if we are parents, maybe we are not always ideal. But you know, when a parent is a good parent, when a parent is a loving parent, what are some aspects of their attitude and actions? Just go ahead and unmute yourself and say something. Ruth Ann, did you have something?
Yes, thank you. I think respect for their offspring as a human being, as a separate human being.
I would say patience with, especially with regards to the mistakes they make.
Offers.
What was that?
Offers encouragement.
Unconditional love.
I guess the first thing that pops into my mind as a parent is safety, looking at the child's safety.
Playfulness, if we can play with our child.
Teacher, advisor. With kindness. I don't know, kind teacher and advisor.
I think I always managed to feel like my parents would always be my fan.
So to tie into the teacher, I would say also learner. I've learned a lot from my kids, things that I couldn't have learned from anybody else.
Hopefully some physical affection, hugs, for example, or...
I guess I would add, along with the playfulness and learning from the child and being a teacher, would be kind of openness, that desire, or realizing that you can't control them, kind of goes along with respecting your child as a separate human being, but realizing that they are their own thing and things are going to come along that you're never going to see coming. You really can't control their development and their path. It's theirs.
Get some water?
I think an important one for me anyway is courage, like allowing them to take risks.
I'm thinking about tough love. Or maybe in some kind of combination with wisdom or caution, you know, helping children, sort of steering them in the right direction so that they don't get hurt while they're still young.
Yeah, I think part of that setting boundaries.
Yes. Yes.
Honesty.
I feel like there's also a yes, that the parent always has the child's, I mean, ideally, right? Always has the child's best interests at heart. There's a selflessness there.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, ideally, it's not about the parent. It's not about the parent being loved or right or needed or something like that. It's really about And I'm curious as to when we think about extending this parental mind into many circumstances and extending it to beings beyond just our children, you know, it reminds me of metta in a way. This is another attitude that we're asked to cultivate and extend. So I'm curious about what people think is like, I mean, in many ways, you could see an overlap here, right? Metta being goodwill. But it feels to me like there's just a little extra with the parental mind, the attitude of the parent. Almost, you know, so what do you see maybe being special about this attitude of a parent, that kind of in addition to the metta?
Well, there's a deeper connection because, I mean, when we practice metta, we can certainly do that to our loved ones, including our children, but we also practice it on behalf of the postman and the grocery store clerk. Whereas with our children, you know, there's that familial connection.
There's also a physical responsibility, right, that we don't necessarily have with the rest of the world. Well, I guess that's arguable, but...
Right.
But it's definitely a stronger responsibility. Mm-hmm.
And there's a speaking of that connection, it's like that connection is to some extent not an option. I mean, obviously, the amount of care and concern and degree of relationship a parent has with their child is somewhat optional, but the fact, the very fact of that relationship can't be changed. Where, you know, we have spouses, we have friends, we have other people in our lives that we may be very close to for a while, but then, you know, by choice, we might no longer be connected to. Also, there's an attitude of the parent that if you do your job really well, you won't be needed anymore. You're looking to make yourself obsolete. You know, I guess that ties back to that, the best interests of the child. That
you know when to let go.
Well, that's the hope. I have a friend who's a therapist who wrote a book called I Thought I'd Be Done By Now, Help for Parents of Adult Kids. Right. You're never finished.
Yeah.
I guess it's the goal, but your heart, your care, I mean, they're always your child. You'll always care so deeply.
Yes, I think
go ahead.
It's a contract you make. I think it's deeper than social. Of course, there are people who don't follow through, but it's a kind of contract that you enter into, you being the adult, and as you say, part of your heart. And I just think it's on a deeper level that humans are capable of.
I was also thinking of a willingness to, you know, as you are guiding and teaching and supporting, I guess it does tie into like learning from the child, but also like being willing to adapt, you know, your actions, your approach, your language, whatever, as needed. Like what does the child need, as opposed to this is what I want to give them. I mean, that's the ideal, right? So all of this stuff, just like metta, in Buddhist practice, we are aiming to extend. So this is where it becomes a spiritual practice, is where we're trying to extend these things beyond where we feel them naturally, obviously, hopefully, with a child. Or certain other beings in our life for whom we feel some responsibility, but to extend that attentiveness, that goodwill, that sense of responsibility, that loving kindness, that gentleness, that willingness to adapt, to be unconditionally supportive, that we extend that beyond our children, we extend that beyond our immediate family, to acquaintances, co-workers, strangers, people outside our social group, people with different opinions, cultures, political beliefs. and even to everything we encounter, not just people. So in on page 53, Uchiyama is talking about this, how in the Tenzo Kyoken, he talks about taking this parental mind and extending it toward what the Tenzo is encountering. So he says, there is an old saying which goes, see the pot as your own head, see the water as your lifeblood. Another passage, a few paragraphs previous to the one above, says, clean the chopsticks, ladles, and all other utensils. Handle them with equal care and awareness, putting everything back where it naturally belongs. To handle them with equal care and awareness is very important. In other words, when you work with some tool or utensil, you should put it back when you are finished with it, and not just leave it sitting around. When you will put a pot down roughly, banging it on a concrete or a tiled sink, it cries out in pain. If you are still unable to hear that cry, then you can hardly be said to be a person living out Zazen in your daily life. So, what about this extending parental minds, like that list that we just made of the attitude and actions of a parent? How do you extend that to your cooking pots? Obviously, this is kind of literally, right? You're not like trying to raise your cooking pot so it can become independent. There's some things that don't directly apply, but so how does that attitude apply? Look back at that list. Respect, patience. I guess a pot doesn't need encouragement, but I mean, obviously we're extending this, not just physical objects, we're extending this to all of our activities. So in our activities, we may encounter people. Unconditional love, learning, openness. Any thoughts on like how this translates?
I do have a thought, and you know, one thing I would add to this list, I think it was actually said and it didn't make it to the list, but as it relates to openness, being open to being taught by the child, you know, what does this experience have to teach me? You know, with the pots and the pans, it's one thing, but one way I get there, you know, somebody jokingly said when I was heading out to my rose garden that I should talk to them. And so every now and then I do. Like, I have a couple of little roses here that I accidentally cut because I was trimming the bush and they got in the way. And, oh, I'm so apologetic when that happens, and I take such good care of that, and I'm so sorry. And then sometimes I say, look, I'm doing my best here. Show me what you want. What do I need to be doing here? And I've been very fortunate not only to work with you, Domio, in the kitchen, but also I've had a lot of stints in the kitchen at Great Val. And watching the others, especially the senior practitioners, so carefully working with rice and chopping up vegetables and, you know, taking something and putting it on a surface like that quietly. To me, that is one of the reasons why I've always liked it, is that is a place where I can put my practice from the cushion into my everyday life.
Yes, when you asked the question, Domio, about the cooking pot, it's like the Native American people say, it's like whatever picture scene is in front of us as we breathe, we're sharing the space so that a child of ours is, we're on the path together because we're sharing something, even if it's the day. And so the cooking pot, there's a purpose. We recognize the two entities, myself as the cook and the tool. So it's like we're in the scene together, and the stove becomes the altar or the arena where you argue with a child that doesn't want to hear your words. We're sharing that space together, and so come to it as the parent, come to it with that respect, that view.
I like that.
So for me, the word that comes to mind is stewardship. And it's not really an ownership. I'm not the boss of either the person or the thing or the process. It's really this relationship where I give it space. I give it nurturing when I need to. You know, and I think that can apply to things as well as, you know, nouns as well as actions.
When you are a cook, especially when you're cooking for other people, particularly a group, you're taking your raw ingredients, which are things that have potential, and you're guiding them through until you have a finished product. You do it with intent and carefully and caring. And when you're done, that food is presented to the world. Much like a child who is really just, as an infant, someone with potential. When they become an adult, you are essentially presenting them to the world.
Nice. I like that, like that sense that we're just participating. It's like the parent doesn't really make the child, right? I mean, they're just, this child appears and you're just facilitating the growth. You're just supporting the development of something, participating in the development of something. You're not in charge.
Like that kind of. I like what Gaffel was talking about in terms of preparing food. I mean, I'm sure there are people who don't enjoy cooking at all, not even for themselves, but for some of us, there really is a lot of love going on in there, you know? And when you offer it to your family or your friends, it's kind of a love offering.
Definitely. Some of this is our best way of expressing our love.
Cooking involves so much doing with your hands and your eyes and your senses, your sense of taste and your sense of smell, and even listening to certain things. It's an activity that parents, I think, have a hard time, especially when you're tired and you've been working all day and so forth. It's not easy to pay attention to what you're doing with your hands and how you are receiving and interpreting all the sensory information that you're getting. And sometimes the child or the dish comes out very badly, you know, in that sense. I mean, not real, well, with a dish, maybe it's ruined forever and you can't take the salt out of it that you put in, you know. But it's kind of a give and take like that, I think, that the parental aspect is very much a give and take.
And you're reminding me of the aspect of it where, which is very obvious when you use the example of a parent and a child, where everything you do matters. Where, you know, it's perhaps more difficult when we think about other activities or other interactions where we think, eh. But in this one example, we know whether we're parents or whether we were children of parents, right? Yeah. Whether the parent pays attention, whether the parent is annoyed, whether the parent is kind, what the parent says, what the parent hears really matters.
Yeah. I'm reminded of how much the two terms we use a lot being mindfulness, how much mindfulness it takes and how much awareness it takes to be a good cook and a good parent. You know, and that really takes energy and dedication and application, and sometimes it's really hard.
Yeah, it takes experimentation to a certain extent. You try this and it's not quite right, so the next time you try something else. And if you bring that openness to the situation, it can help the child too.
And you have to keep doing that.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to be a good parent, that is, because you can't give up. It's not like, well, this is frustrating, nothing's working. I'm going to walk away. So again, in that example, like with the child, it's so obvious, like, extending that kind of sense of responsibility to other activities, other people, other situations. Just we're much, frankly, less likely to feel that way, right? About our other relationships, about our communities, that we are, it needs us. We are responsible.
Yeah, I think, like, as we're talking about this, I'm thinking about cooking and how, in a way, that's kind of a softball because not everybody likes to cook, but, you know, it's definitely an expression of love for many people. It's creative. There's a lot of kind of qualities that if you get into it, it's kind of like, you know, it's expressive and it's easy to kind of sink your teeth into. I'm thinking more like, what about the laundry? You know, like, that's a thing that we have to do. And in theory, we could bring that same mental energy to it. But my guess is most of us don't. At least I don't.
Yeah.
We don't. None of you are probably used to washing diapers. We used to do that.
I did with my daughter.
Yeah.
And
that's gone, you know.
I did with one, not the other two.
Yeah, I mean, like, but if your job involves spreadsheets, you know, what is parental mind when you're doing that? You know, it occurs to me that part of it is perhaps seeing in what way it is an offering, maybe.
I guess one way maybe I would tie cooking to spreadsheets as someone who's worked really extensively with spreadsheets. When I was thinking about this, I was trying to, you know, the chapter opens with the discussion of big mind, and so I kind of connected parental mind to big mind, like what are their relationship? I guess that's what I focused on when I read this. And so they talk about, you know, big mind is feeling connected to everything and living in kind of that almost transcendent one state of oneness, but how that's not possible for an everyday existence. And brought to my mind, I forget who said this, but the idea of like, if you lived in transcendence all the time and ever you were one with everything, you wouldn't know, kind of follow the food analogy, like which mouth to put your food in, right? Because all mouths would be your mouth, you know? So like, it's just not realistic to live all the time in big mind. And so, but we can't go back to that mind of opposition, which I think he mentions on page 51 and maybe 52, where we see everything as not us, and so we don't care. And so I saw parental mind as a way to honor big mind while still recognizing things in the world, not living in transcendence. And so when I thought of cooking, I thought of the process of cooking and how, you know, someone mentioned earlier, and I really liked it, that the raw materials, you are one with them. We all come from the earth, whether it's metal or wood for utensils or the materials themselves. And you can't alter them, just like you can't alter the personalities of your children. You can't alter their flavor. You can't alter their texture. And so you have to be thoughtful and playful in how you combine them together. You have to think about what's the best way to use them. And then when you are cooking, you have to give all the ingredients like time. You have to be patient with letting them simmer if they have to simmer, otherwise they'll burn, right? And so like with working with spreadsheets, I had a job once where I spent 4 months in front of a computer, 8 hours a day, entering data into spreadsheets. And I can tell you that was awful. But it's so easy to get lost. And just like you're a cook, like mentioned earlier, the parent who just at the end of the day just doesn't have the patience, is very tired, you know, not aware. It's really easy to let your mind wander and to not think about what you're doing, to not respect the numbers, to not even think about what those numbers mean. You know, the whole reason of putting together a spreadsheet is to create some sort of table of data to then do something with that data. And so if you don't take care in what the numbers mean or they're telling you and their relationship to each other, what's the best way to analyze them? What is impact is this going to have in the people who read it? And take your time and patience. You can't rush through even tasks we don't like, I guess. I don't know if that made sense, but
so for me, being another spreadsheet cruncher, it doesn't matter, or in the past, not so much now, it doesn't, you know, whatever you do should have a mind of customer service. Mm. Whether your customer is outside of your business purchasing something from you, or if it's the next person downstream from you that needs the data you're creating, or your boss, your leadership team. So I did tons and tons of scorecarding and things in the past, and it was, how do you make the information easy to digest? How do you make it aesthetically pleasing to look at, the graphs? I'm in a business that's very visual, so it was very important to make the information both visually captivating in a very short amount of time and, you know, palatable. So there's a lot of cooking in spreadsheets.
Here's another analogy, I guess. And it seems to me that spreadsheets are only as good as the information that you put in. So I've heard this term, garbage in, garbage out. Mm-hmm. Same thing with parenting kids. You put bad garbage in, or, you know, stuff that is not going to be beneficial. And it's no surprise when your kids are not in tune with that either. I think with a spreadsheet, you need to be very careful about what information you put in, because once you put it in, it tends to stay, even if it's wrong.
How about driving? How do you drive with parental mind?
Everybody else is stupid and wrong.
Driving is my Achilles heel.
What was that?
I think it's kind of my Achilles heel.
Ah, yes.
Things that can make me unreasonably angry. Although I'm getting good at catching myself and saying, okay, just let it go. But there it is. Driving is not something I think that we have evolved far enough to actually do.
I know that, I mean, maybe some of it is that, it's interesting that, I don't know, there's almost seems like there's two ways to go about it. One is to think about the purpose of what you're doing. You know, when you're cooking and you're doing this to nourish people that you love, or, you know, you're working on a project and you're thinking about the people it's going to impact and you want to do a good job. And so if you're driving somewhere, maybe you think about the purpose for which you're doing this, the joy of being able to serve or something like that. But then there's also that aspect of just like in this moment, you know, there's like the relationship to the car or the relationship to the warm clothes that you just took out of the dryer, which somehow somebody made for you in order to clothe yourself, and, you know, your good fortune in having a dryer, and now they're clean and you can fold them up, and, you know, there's that kind of in the moment appreciation and intimacy with whatever we're working with as well.
I was wondering that too, because I think it's Fujiyama who said, I can't remember if it's this book or in the opening The Hand of Thought. Uchiyama, you may have just been repeating it. Whatever you encounter is your lie. Mm-hmm. You know, everything you encounter is your lie. And the fact that we're so discriminating when we encounter our life, that we find these little things are important, and this vast majority of it is really not so important. And I think that's one of the, you know, that's one of the sad things about how we function. And then I think about Thich Nhat Hanh, who seems like he's become a person, it seems, that there are no unimportant things in his life. Everything he encounters seems immensely important to him. You know, he's got these big long lists of all these little, I don't know what they're called, but they're like almost like prayers or poems or something. When he washes his hands, when he, you know, all these different things, every moment of his life is consciously important to him. So that's kind of ties to that, you know, there's what's the outcome, but also just the fact that this is your life.
Yeah, I think when we get, even if the outcomes are noble, that becomes kind of a way to motivate us to do the things that we find painful in the moment, for the most part. I'm thinking about Sydney's spreadsheet story. I mean, the only way that you could keep doing that is certainly not, well, I mean, in theory, you could get into putting numbers into a spreadsheet, but I mean, it's got to be about the outcome, whether it's a paycheck or maybe there's a, you know, maybe the data is important to her and other people. But, you know, again, that's the outcome. And so I think it becomes a motivational aspect, but it's less of a experiential kind of thing. And so I don't know. It seems maybe missing the point a little bit.
Well, it strikes me that another aspect that this I mean, I wouldn't even want to say child metaphor. It's not a metaphor, but like to some extent, this comparison, it's like of a parental mind and the mind that we want to be cultivating toward all things. It's also an aspect there of the selflessness. So, you know, that parent protecting the child from the heat or from the cold, or making sure the child has what they want there. And, you know, even like they often say their only child, and that sense where the parent is not responding in a way that's like, well, you know, kind of what am I going to get out of this? Is this interesting? Is this going to be rewarding? Like, the self is not involved in that calculation. You know, how much attention am I going to pay? How much care am I going to take? So that it feels like there's that invitation to see these various things that we're doing as not separate from us.
Yeah, I think one thing I liked that we mentioned earlier, and I think I might have changed a little bit when I wrote it down in my notes, encouragement and support. Oh, I think you mentioned being a fan, being your child's biggest fan. And I wrote down to champion like the cause of the child. And I think it's one thing that I learned when I was going through grad school, and I had to write papers on topics that I hated, and I like really, really didn't want to write a paper on whatever I was assigned to do. It kind of feeds into what you're talking about. Like, what do I get out of this? Like, I don't want to do it. I'm totally averse to this topic. I think it's stupid. I'm going to get nothing out of it. But then you have to set that feeling aside and find something valuable in it. And that's one thing that I learned in grad school, how to switch that around in my head, that like, okay, I might not like this artist. I might not like this painting, but I'm going to find something in it that's going to be so important that everyone's going to want to know about it. And, you know, I teach science now, and so I look at a lot of scientific literature, and there are whole books written about like the potato and like salt. There's literally a book called Salt, and it's just the history of salt, and, you know, the history of the color purple, and, you know, like the history of the color red, and like, you know, and you're like, who would write a book about that? But it's amazing when you can flip your mind around to championing something to make it the most important thing, and take your own feelings out of that equation and really holding it up in the light so that it can get the attention that it deserves. That selflessness. And I think we can do that with anything. It's just a matter of putting ourselves in the right mind space to do that. Mm.
I'm enthused. Good pep talk.
I have to admit, it's much harder to do than it is to say it. It takes a lot of practice. But yeah, I think it's a good lesson to learn. And I think that ties it back to the experiential part. You know, when you can get really into one thing that you're doing and just become absorbed by that and champion that. And, you know, like when you're cooking a dish and you make, I don't know, eggplant the center of the dish because you just love eggplant, and it's all about the eggplant, and it's not about you at all. It's about making the eggplant star of the dish. And I think that's one way to keep yourself in the experience rather than looking too far into the future and thinking about the goal as opposed to what you're actually doing.
It seems like it's a bit of what you were describing was to overcome a feeling of disinterest, maybe bore and boredom. And I, you know, my middle school students, boredom is like, that's the worst malady that can befall anybody. Boredom is just, and I always tell them, guys, boredom is a self-inflicted injury. You know, if you're bored, you know, you need to look at yourself, because that's, you're doing it to yourself.
I'm just curious whether anybody has any examples of instances where, other than cooking, because we've talked a lot about cooking, where you do find yourself that is fairly easy to bring up this this parental mind, this attitude of real responsibility and attention and care. Some particular activity you do, or maybe it's your work.
I like to fix things around the house, and so when I'm fixing something, I get pretty meticulous about it, and I want everything to function very smoothly and properly, and so it takes me a long time, but maybe in that kind of a mindset, yeah.
The care and a satisfaction when it's done well, and it's...
I think gardening is definitely has that paternal bit to it, whether you're gardening for food or gardening for flowers and beauty. It definitely fits into that realm of parenting your plants. And for many people, it's, you know, very much a love interest.
Artistic endeavor, whatever it is that you choose for artistic expression. For me, it's photography or painting.
It's what?
Photography or painting. Mm-hmm. Or for, I met, you know, you're a poet. I imagine similar for you and Ruth Ann. Her poems are also very beautiful. You know, poetry, writing in general, any kind of art.
Well, I'll wrap up with one more paragraph from Uchiyama about this way of bringing parental mind to anything. This is the bottom of page 54. And he's, because he was complaining about public officials in Japan who just like going through the motions, just getting their paycheck, just not really caring about their job. He said, if these public officials truly felt their lives were worth something, they would naturally see their work as their child. Forget about their personal inconvenience and endeavor to help those who come to them. I have felt this way for some time. And if you, the reader, just happen to be a public official, not like those I have been describing, then that, of course, is quite fine. In fact, everyone hopes there might be more officials who are conscientious about their work. Devoting the whole of life's ardor to all the circumstances and people we encounter in our lives, in the same way do we devote ourselves to our own children, is precisely how we find the true meaning of life. So I was reflecting on the benefit of parental mind. So if we are still kind of approaching this from the idea of self versus other, this could be seen as a way for us to be of benefit to others, or to be of benefit to the world, or, you know, because we're paying more attention, we're taking more care, we're taking more responsibility. So in a way, it's kind of a benefit of others. But of course, as Dogen says elsewhere, in the Shishobo, he said, foolish people think that if they help others first, their own benefit will be lost. But this is not so. Beneficial action is an act of oneness, benefiting self and others together. So as parent and child are connected in a way that can never be denied or changed, no matter the circumstances, I mean, this is extending this sense of connectedness to all beings and to all being. the sense that we are permanently, inextricably connected. And I found a kind of a touching story here from One Bird, One Stone by Sean Murphy, 108 Contemporary Zen Stories. And this is from Shugen Arnold in the Daido Lori Roshi lineage. And he has done a lot of work in prisons. So they have prison sanghas. And so this is the story that he's telling. In prison, there's a tremendous emphasis on keeping things suppressed. To be vulnerable to one's feelings can mean opening yourself to a tremendous amount of misery and anguish. There was an inmate who came to me one day and told me, "I've been in prisons a lot rougher than this one. I was in a prison where someone got stabbed nearly every day." He said, "You get so used to it that you just notice it and go back to your conversation. You don't feel it. You just sort of pass over it." But then he told me, "You know, I was in the yard the other day," and this is a prisoner who had been practicing with Shugen for a while. "I was in the yard the other day and someone got stabbed. And for the first time, it went right through me. In that moment, I felt all the pain I carry, that this whole place carries." He said it in the most beautiful way, with innocence, like a child discovering something for the first time. I looked at him and smiled and said, "Welcome back." For me, this was an incredible demonstration of how practice works. If you really engage it over time, you just naturally come back to your own humanity. It was one of those moments that make everything worthwhile. Any closing questions or comments or statements? Oh, you're muted, Bob.
Is it the Metta Sutta that says something about even as a mother cares for her child?
Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah, then that feeling that you have, taking it to everything else that goes on in your life is a pretty big proposition.
Sure is.
Yeah.
As always, it's just a direction, you know, it's just an aspiration that guides us. All right, I'll do a closing verse. "We offer the merit of our study to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita." Thanks for being here.
Good night.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
I was using your comments on the Shishobo. Am I saying that right? The Shishobo?
Uh-huh.
In the key messages. You'll see that again.
Cool.
Really soon.